Now, one of the things which you almost invariably encounter if you use the internet is advertising. So you're on a website reading an article about something or other when all of a sudden a noisy video promoting the latest Volvo or the latest blockbuster movie takes over your screen, and it can be then really quite irritating. And one type of advertising which you find in other contexts but is common on the internet is the before and after type. You know the kind of thing I mean. There's a picture of someone's grossly oversized belly before he has taken the fantastic weight loss product. And then there's a picture of his impressively toned figure having taken the weight loss product, or as a picture of a hideous wine stain before the super duper cleaning agent has been applied, and then there's a picture of the pristine, good as new carpet once the cleaning agent has been applied, and so on. I personally tend to doubt the authenticity of many of these pictures, but obviously some people are impressed by them because it's a popular form of advertising. Before and after. But in actual fact, a couple of millennia before internet advertising, the Apostle Paul was pioneering the before and after approach. And nowhere more strikingly than in Ephesians chapter 2, where he presents, doesn't he, the vivid contrast between his Ephesian readers before conversion and his Ephesian readers after conversion. But this is the interesting thing. He presents that contrast twice. He presents it first of all in verses 1 to 10, and we've considered those verses over the past three Sunday mornings. But then he presents the contrast, the before and after contrast, for a second time in verses 11 to 18 that we're considering this morning. Once again, there's a but now at the beginning of verse 13. And it raises the question then, well, is there a difference between the two passages? Is there any difference between verses 1 to 10 and verses 11 to 18? Well, the answer is yes, there is a difference, and the difference is this. Paul's contrast in verses 1 to 10 is between his Ephesian readers as human beings before and after conversion. His contrast in verses 11 to 18 is between his Ephesian readers as Gentiles before and after conversion. Because that's what his Ephesian readers were, ethnically. They were Gentiles. And Paul is interested here in what it meant for them as Gentiles to become Christians. That's the angle he's coming from now in his before and after contrast in verses 11 to 18. And in that connection then, he offers two pictures. First of all, a picture of disadvantage and hostility before conversion. And then secondly, a picture of peace and equality after conversion. And so we're going to spend a little while looking at these two pictures in turn. So, first of all then, the before picture. A picture of disadvantage and hostility before conversion. So what do I mean then by that? What do I mean by disadvantage, first of all? Well, imagine a great Downton Abbey-style house back in the olden days. And imagine one night it's on fire. And sleeping in the plush bedrooms in the main part of the house are the members of the eminent and wealthy family whose house it is. And because the fire is particularly wild and intense and severe, it will be amazing if any of the family members are rescued from the disaster. As for the servants, In the downstairs quarters, the cooks and maids and stable cleaners, well, they're not even on the radar. Any rescue operation is bound to focus on the family members upstairs. So it's desperate enough, I'm saying, to be in that blazing house at all on that night. But for the servants down in the basement, with no aristocratic blood and with no social status, they are at a relative disadvantage even to others who are in that blazing house. And really, that's what Paul is saying about his Ephesian readers here. That was the situation that they had been in prior to conversion. They were like those servants in the blazing house. They had been part of a race that in its entirety was dead in trespasses and sins. And that was desperate enough. But not only that, they, as Gentiles, had been at a relative disadvantage even to others who were dead in trespasses and sins as part of the human race. And you say, well, how is that? Can that be? If everyone was dead in trespasses and sins, if that is the natural state of everybody, regardless of ethnicity, then how were the Gentiles at a relative disadvantage to others? Well, Paul explains that. You see, once the human race had become dead in trespasses and sins, back there in the Garden of Eden, God didn't lose any time in developing his great rescue operation. He announced promises from that moment. From that moment, he dispensed hope. From that moment, he constructed piece by piece the genetic pipeline from which a Messiah would flow. But this is the thing. It was specifically within Israel that he announced those promises. And it was specifically within Israel that he dispensed hope. And it was specifically within Israel that he constructed that messianic pipeline. The Gentile nations weren't a party to any of that. They didn't receive the promises. They were strangers to the covenants of promise, verse 12. They didn't share in the hope. They had no hope, verse 12. They weren't genetically connected to the Messiah. They were separated from the Christ, verse 12. If you were a Jew belonging to the Commonwealth of Israel, as Paul puts it, then yes, you were dead in trespasses and sins, as dead as anybody else. You can't have degrees of deadness. You're either dead or you're not. If you were a Jew, you were dead in trespasses and sins, and you weren't automatically rescued from that disaster, but at least you were situated where the rescue operation was taking place. At least you were in a position of opportunity, at least to return to my illustration, you were in the main part of the burning house where rescue was on the agenda. But if you were a Gentile, alienated from the Commonwealth of Israel, then you were dead in trespasses and sins. But you weren't situated where the rescue operation was taking place. You were off the radar. You were downstairs in the basement of the burning house. You were in a situation of real disadvantage. And so that's the first component in this picture of the Gentiles before conversion. Theirs was a situation of disadvantage. Yes, all human beings naturally dead in trespasses and sins, but some in an even worse situation than others, namely the Gentiles, because not even in the orbit, not even in the place, if you like, where God was working out his rescue operation. So what do I mean by disadvantage? I mean now, what do I mean by hostility? Well, Paul indicates, doesn't he, in verses 14 and 15 of our text, that not only were the Gentiles prior to conversion worse off than the Jews, not only were they at a relative disadvantage to the Jews, but there was also a bad relationship between these two constituencies. There was a bad relationship between Gentiles and Jews, Jews and Gentiles. There was, Paul says, standing between these two constituencies, a dividing wall of hostility. Verse 14. What was that dividing wall of hostility? Well, he defines it in verse 15 as the law of commandments expressed in ordinances. In other words, the law of Moses. The law which God had given to Moses on Mount Sinai, that was the dividing wall of hostility between Jews and Gentiles. Why? Or how? How was the law of Moses a dividing wall of hostility between Jews and Gentiles? Well, let's think about that. You see, within the law of Moses, there were moral requirements, weren't there? Prohibitions about murder and adultery and theft and so on. There were timeless, absolute moral requirements within the law of Moses, and these were universal in their scope. Paul says elsewhere that they are written indelibly upon the human heart. They are there within the fabric of the human being from birth. So although only the Jews had those moral requirements written by the finger of God on tablets of stone, all human beings have those moral requirements written upon their hearts, embedded within their consciences. So that's one aspect of the law of Moses. There were those moral requirements universal in their scope. But then also in the law of Moses, there were amoral requirements, which were just for the Jews. And these amoral requirements then made the Jews a very different and distinctive people to any other people in their daily lifestyle. And those requirements made it actually very difficult for the Jews to live peacefully alongside other Gentile peoples. And those requirements inevitably created tensions between the Jews and surrounding Gentile peoples. So, for instance, laws about food. Within the law of Moses, there were requirements about food. The Jews were only to eat certain types of foods. And that meant then that some foods which the Gentiles regarded as delicacies, as fine dishes, food that they would set out at banquets and feasts, the Jews would label that food unclean. Now that was hardly calculated to cause harmony and friendliness between the two constituencies, when some of the Gentiles' finest delicacies were labeled unclean by the Jews. That would create tensions, wouldn't it? Or then there is the law about circumcision, the requirement of circumcision. All Jewish males were to be circumcised. And that was an even more sensitive issue then between the two constituencies. It was one thing for Jews to have a problem with the Gentile diet. It was another thing for Jews to have a problem with the Gentile anatomy, with their bodily features. And you sense some of the tension, actually, in the way Paul writes verse 11, don't you? Remember that at one time you Gentiles in the flesh called the uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision. In other words, this is what the two groups called each other. Those Gentiles there, the uncircumcision. Those Jews there, the circumcision. They didn't kind of say, oh yes, those other folk who just happen to have a different policy than we do regarding the male foreskin. No, they labelled them the uncircumcision, the circumcision. There was this tension created by this particular requirement in the law of Moses. And so we could go on with many other requirements in the Mosaic law which were calculated to create disharmony, to create tension and hostility between Jews and Gentiles. And so that's the picture then of the Ephesian readers as Gentiles before conversion. It's a picture of disadvantage on the one hand and of hostility on the other hand. And it raises the question then, once these Gentiles, these Ephesians, are converted, once they are raised to life, as we've been looking at in the last three Sunday mornings, once they've been raised from their deadness and they have been joined to Jesus Christ and they have become Christian people, and they find themselves then in the people of God alongside Jewish believers, are these two things we've just considered going to continue? Within the church, within the people of God, are Gentile believers still going to be somehow at a disadvantage to Jewish believers? Are they going to be second-class citizens? Are they going to be second-rate believers compared to the Jewish ones? And is there still going to be this tension, this hostility between Gentile believers and Jewish believers? Outside of Christ, there was disadvantage and hostility. What about once the Gentiles have been converted and they're in the church with Jewish believers? What happens then? Is there still disadvantage? Is there still hostility? That's the big question. And that's why we must move on then to the second picture, the after picture. A picture of peace and equality after conversion. Because the answer to our question, or the answers to our questions, are no, these two things don't continue. Once the Gentiles have been converted and come into the church alongside believing Jews, there's no longer disadvantage and hostility. Instead, there's peace and equality. So let's just look quickly at those two things. First of all, peace. Where once there was hostility, there is now peace in the church between believing Gentiles and believing Jews. How then? How does that come about? Well, Paul gives, I think, perhaps two reasons in our text. So, first of all, he talks about a destruction, doesn't he? He talks about Christ having destroyed the law of Moses. He has broken down the dividing wall of his hostility. He has abolished the law of commandments expressed in ordinances. You see, this law of Moses, these amoral requirements I've been talking about, they had an important role to play for a few centuries. The role, I think they had perhaps various roles, but one role at least was this, that by making the Jews so outwardly distinctive and different, the law of Moses was impressing upon the Jews that they were inwardly and morally to be different and distinctive as God's people. Just as they were distinctive in what they ate and in practices like circumcision, so they were to be different and distinctive in how they behaved, how they thought, how they conducted themselves at the deepest levels. So it was a kind of illustration. We read there in Galatians 3 that during that Old Testament period, God was treating the Jews as a kind of underage child, a child that still needs to be taught lessons in very visual ways. And so God was teaching the Jews about distinctiveness in a very visual way, food, circumcision, these kinds of things. So it was necessary for a while, for a period, that there should be those amoral requirements. But now, Paul says, Jesus Christ has come along and he has ended that period. Through his death, that's, I think he refers to blood in verse 13, he refers to flesh in verse 14. He seems to be referring to Christ's death on Calvary. And at that point then, at that point, those amoral requirements terminated. At that point, they ceased. And so at that point, the tensions that they would otherwise create between Jewish believers and Gentile believers became irrelevant. Within the church, Jewish believers no longer bound by these law, these amoral requirements. And so the cause of those tensions has been removed. So Christ has destroyed something, but then he's also created something, because we read in verse 15 that he created in himself one new man in place of the two. And I think the point there is this, that at conversion then, whether you are a Jew or a Gentile, at conversion, you assume a new identity. Your identity, your most basic identity, is no longer derived from your ethnicity. Who you are is no longer ultimately determined by your race, by your kin. Yes, you are still a Jew or a Gentile, and in certain circumstances that may have some significance, but that is no longer your basic identity, because Christ has created this new man, and you derive your basic identity now from that. Who are you? Not ultimately, I'm a Jew or I'm a Gentile, but I belong to this new body of Jesus Christ. That's who I am. That's where I derive my ultimate identity. It's what Paul meant there in Galatians 3, where he said that there's no longer any Jew or Greek, no longer any male or female, no longer any slave or free. Of course, in certain circumstances, those distinctions did still apply. Elsewhere, Paul will teach about male roles and female roles within marriage and within the church. So he's not abolishing gender distinctions altogether. He's not saying that if you're employed as a slave, you should go into work on Monday morning and start acting as the boss from now on because you're a Christian. Elsewhere, he shows that those employment distinctions do still matter. But the point is that in the Church of Jesus Christ, after you've become a Christian, you no longer derive your basic identity from your gender, from your race, from your employment, from your social status, your salary, anything like that. Who are you fundamentally? You are a person who is part of the body of Jesus Christ. And again then, that removes those tensions that otherwise might have been there across all those first century churches where there were Jewish members in the congregation and there were Gentile members in the congregation. And it seemed a recipe for friction and tension and disaster. And Paul is saying, no, there can be peace. Because number one, the law of Moses now is finished. And number two, the fact you're Jews and Gentiles is no longer the most important thing about you. You belong to the body of Jesus Christ. That's your identity. So peace, that's part of the picture for these Gentiles following conversion. Then equality. Equality. Are then the are then Gentile believers within the Church of God in any sense second-rate citizens? Are they in any sense disadvantaged? Are they in any sense lagging behind Jewish believers in the Church of God? And Paul's answer is an emphatic no. There's equality. Because Jew and Gentile share in the Church of God exactly the same salvation. Let's break that down. First of all, exactly the same reconciliation. He says that, verse 16, that Christ has reconciled us both to God in one body. So Jew and Gentile believers enjoy exactly the same reconciliation to God. It's the most basic privilege, isn't it, of the gospel. It's the most basic thing about becoming a Christian. You're reconciled to God. Before that, you're his enemies. Then you're reconciled to him. And Paul is saying that Jewish believers don't have an even better reconciliation than Gentile believers. God doesn't welcome Jewish believers with open arms and give a formal handshake to Gentile believers. Now, every believer, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of background, every believer in Jesus Christ experiences the same reconciliation with God. Same reconciliation. Secondly, the same proclamation. This is interesting. Verse 17, Christ, he's still the agent here, the actor here. Christ came and preached peace to you who were far off and peace to those who were near. What's that talking about? Well, Paul is alluding to a passage from Isaiah, but the basic assumption here is one that I've referred to several times in our service this morning. That when the gospel is preached, yes, there is a human preacher, but ultimately it's Jesus Christ who is preaching. Christ is the preacher of his own gospel. Christ is the one who proclaims the gospel whenever the gospel is proclaimed. And what Paul is saying here then is that Christ went and preached that gospel to those who were near, that is to the Jews who were in the main part of the burning house. But Christ also went down into the basement and preached peace to those who were far off, the Gentiles. In other words, he's saying, whether you're a Jewish believer or a Gentile believer, when you heard the gospel, it was Jesus who was speaking it to you. Jesus didn't go personally and preach the gospel to Jews and then delegate some angel to do it to Gentiles. No, when Peter preached the gospel to Jews in Jerusalem, it was Christ who was preaching through Peter. But equally, when Paul preached the gospel to pagan Gentiles in Ephesus and Corinth and Thessalonica and all these other places, Jesus was the one who was preaching through him. The same Jesus preaching regardless of the ethnicity of the audience. So the same reconciliation, the same proclamation, and thirdly the same access. There in verse 18, through him we both have access in one spirit to the Father. I think he's talking there then about that ongoing access in worship and prayer which believers enjoy from the moment of conversion. It's in the Spirit. That may well, I think, be a reference to what Reese was talking about on Wednesday night, that is expanded in Romans 8, the Spirit's assuring ministry that we can run to God, that we are God's children, we can cry Abba. That's perhaps what Paul has in mind again here. But he's saying that every believer, Jew or Gentile, has that same access. It's not that Jewish believers can run right into the very throne room and call upon God with great intimacy, whereas Gentile believers must stand further back and shout out their requests in much more formal language. No, every believer, the same access constantly into God's presence. And so those are the two pictures then. In verses 1 to 10, we have two pictures of the Ephesians before and after conversion, but that's just the Ephesians generally as human beings. Here in verses 11 to 18, we have two more pictures of the Ephesians before and after conversion, but here it's the Ephesians as Gentiles. Before conversion, a picture of disadvantage and hostility. After conversion, a picture of peace and equality. But just one more thing as we close this morning. I think it's worth noting that really with this morning's sermon, we have moved into a new section of the Epistle to the Ephesians. I think probably the first main section is chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 10. And we've moved this morning then into a second section of the Epistle. And I think there's a logical progression, as you'd expect with the Apostle Paul, as the Epistle moves forward. And it's this, that in chapter 1, I think the high watermark, if you like, of chapter 1 is chapter 1, verse 10, where Paul has set out God's great plan for all of history, that he is going to unite all things in Jesus Christ. Remember, many weeks ago now, we talked about that, how since the fall, the universe itself has been kind of dislocated. And it's been in a state of disharmony, it's been dysfunctional. But God is, at the end, through Jesus Christ, going to bring it back together into a proper, fully functioning, working cosmos. He's going to unite all these kind of disparate elements of a broken universe. He's going to bring it back together and make it work properly. That's God's great plan. That's God's will. So God's will is to unite all things in Christ. What Paul is now saying in this middle section of Ephesians is this. There's already a little glimpse of that ultimate plan in the church. God's will is to unite all things in Christ. Well, already he's uniting all believers in Christ. And if you don't think that God has the potential, that God has the ability to bring the universe back together at the end, then just look, Paul says, at what he's doing now in little congregations across the first century world. He's bringing the most disparate ethnic groups together in Jesus Christ. Jews and Gentiles who, outside of Christ, are at loggerheads. He's bringing them together in one body. And that is a powerful little microcosm. That is a powerful little trailer. As a powerful little preview of what God is finally going to unveil as he pulls up the curtain on the last day and shows us the universe itself restored and reunified. If you like, and I think this is one of Paul's great concerns, it's God saying to the devil and all the devil's evil cohorts, he's saying, look, this is what I'm doing. Despite all your frustrations, despite all your impediments, all your obstacles, this is what I'm doing. I am uniting the universe back together. And you can see it happening already in the church of Jesus Christ. And that's why it's, number one, a wonderful thing to be part of the Christian church. This community where previous tensions and barriers and walls are gone and we are reconciled fully in Jesus Christ, regardless of background, regardless of anything. And it's why, number two, and this is what Paul will come to in the final section of the epistle, we must be jealous of that unity. It is objective, it's real. But nonetheless, we can sometimes fail to actually live it out and practice it. So, as those who have been brought into a reconciled community, let's be those who practice reconciliation and who are jealous of the unity between believers. Amen.